formal lecture today. I'd like to try to get across a few ideas, and I want to give not even a sketch of a proof of something, but just a sort of vague account of what a particular proof looks like. I hope you've got the idea by now that Rasbarov is a pretty clever person. Now, there are two ways of really intimidating other mathematicians. And Rasbarov does them both, which makes him a very frightening man. So one way is you prove theorems that are so sort of amazing that other people think, gosh, I could never have done that. The other way is you actually establish that things that you can't prove, other people can't prove either. Rasbarov, I think to be Rasbarov, what you think is you try very hard to solve a problem, and if you fail, you think, I'm Sasha Rasbarov. There must be a very good reason why I failed. And then you go and find the reason. And that's what he did in the most extraordinary piece of work with Stephen Rudich. So this is a result of Rasbarov's Rudich. But I'm wrong. I'm just going to try and tell you what the statement is. And just give some very vague idea of how they go about proving it. So what they did is they defined a notion of a natural proof. For establishing lower bounds of circuit complexity. They define some notion of natural proof, and I'll tell you what that is. And they looked at all known lower bounds for circuit complexity. This is for general circuit complexity, not monotone circuit complexity now. So this is circuit complexity where you're allowed an octet. So they looked for all lower bounds that are known. So these are lower bounds not for an arbitrary circuit, because there are no very good, I think 3n, as I said, was the best known lower bound for an NP problem for an arbitrary circuit. But you can do other things like restricting the depth of a circuit, so that the depth of a circuit is the length of the longest path from the input to the output. And you can also look at formulas, which I just said, allow you to get slightly better lower bounds. And there are other, there's the width of the circuit, that's roughly the amount of, if you sort of follow a circuit computation, after a while you say, I don't need this node of the circuit anymore, I can forget what it was. And then they said the width of the circuit would be roughly the largest number of bits that you keep having, that you need to know at any one stage. So that corresponds roughly to the memory that you need when you're doing an actual computer program. So various other restrictions like that, and there are lower bounds proved for those, and they show that all known lower bound techniques were natural in their sense, or if not explicitly natural, could be trivially naturalized. Or not trivially, actually. In one case there was one which was not trivially naturalized, but actually there was either they were obviously natural, or with a bit of thought you could see that they were easily equivalent to some sort of natural proof. So basically no known techniques were unnatural in their sense, and there was no natural proof that P didn't equal NP or for a circuit lower bound. Now, that's not quite the whole story. That is conditional on the result that it's hard to solve the discrete logarithm problem. So the discrete logarithm problem is the problem, I give you some generator A of the multiplicative group of integers mod P, and I give you an x, and I say, what's the log of x mod a? In other words, what power of a, I know a generates a multiplicative group, what power of a gives you x? And if p has lots of digits, that seems to be a very hard problem, and indeed the hardness of that problem is more or less equivalent. It may be equivalent to the hardness of factorizing, so this is one of those things that if this problem were easy, then as we'll see later in the course, then you could factorize large numbers and so on. We all believe that you can't do that, or hope that you can't do that. And so we've got this rather strange thing. Let me just say it again, just to bring out its strangeness. There's no natural proof that P doesn't equal NP, unless this particular NP problem turns out to be easy. So if you... sort of seems the wrong way around. in order to get a natural proof that P doesn't equal NP, you need this problem to be easy. But actually, this problem is not NP complete. So if you can prove that this problem is easy, it doesn't actually prove that P doesn't equal NP. Even so, that may seem a little odd until I say roughly how they go about things. So how could that come into it? Well, first, let's say what the natural proof is. It's a little bit of a hard concept to get your head around. But let's have, all right, Fn equals the set of all Boolean functions on N bits, which we can also think of as subsets of 0, 1 to N in a normal way. We associate a function with a set of values where it takes the value 1. Now, actually, we're going to think of Boolean functions not as subsets of 0, 1 to the n, but as elements as 0, 1 sequences on length capital N equals 2 to the N. So how do we do that? Well, we do it just by the truth table. So you take the elements of 0, 1 to the N and you just list them in, let's say, binary, as though they're binary numbers. You list them in order. So you just 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. And for each one, you just say, is f of this 1, is it, or is it 0? And you get a string of length 2 to the n, which tells you what f was. Now, we've got to think the reason that the notion of a natural proof is slightly hard to grasp is that we've got 0, 1 to the little n to hold in our heads, and we've also got 0, 1 to the capital N. And most of the time, we're going to be talking about 0, 1 to the capital N, which seems a rather bizarre objects to consider, but nevertheless. So a set of Boolean functions can be thought of as a Boolean function defined on 0, 1 to the capital N. Okay, so now what do they mean by natural proof? Well, supposing you've got some Boolean function F and you want to prove that it has high circuit complexity, then I'm actually now more or less directly quoting from either the Rasbroff-Rudish paper or some account, but I can't remember now whether it was something I read on the web or whether it's an actual paper. But anyway, if you want to prove that F has high circuit complexity, then probably you're going to want to use some property of F that will cause it to have high circuit complexity. I suppose in theory it could just work from the definition of that particular function F and prove something that just wouldn't generalize to any other F at all, but that seems quite unlikely. It seems quite likely that there would be some property of F, so we've got some function F in Fn, we'd have some property Cn that applied to F, so Cn roughly means F is complex or something in some particular set, for which we could prove that F belongs to Cn, but no function with low circuit complexity belongs to Cn. Now, so strategies, doomed strategies, I should say, find a property Cn such that F, which is, say, the function corresponding to the set of graphs that contain a clique of such and such a size, such that F has, or F belongs to Cn, and no function of low circuit complexity has property Cn. Now, I've actually got one. Cn is a property of having high circuit complexity. So that's a slightly stupid thing because it just leads to a circular argument. So somehow you want to find some property that actually gets you somewhere. When I say I've got one, I can't prove that that works. I can't prove the statement that F has property CN. So, nevertheless, there is a candidate property, but it's completely useless. So, here are two things that you might expect a property to have, and these are what you would call natural. So we say, CN, strictly speaking, is a sequence, 1 to infinity, is a natural, let's say a natural proof. Never mind whether a sequence of sets can be a proof or something like that. It corresponds to a natural proof. If we can find some subset, in some of the cases it was, of the known lower bounds, it was obvious that the property that was being used to demonstrate that a function had higher complexity was itself going to have the property we want. Sometimes, in order to naturalize some proof, you had to pass to some appropriate subset. Anyway, so there's a slight technicality. Such that the first property is the slightly less bizarre of the two. The proportion of F in Fn that belongs to Cn star over some polynomial in M. We'll stop, sorry. Sound observers. Sentence. So at least some polynomial fraction of all Boolean functions have this property. Now, when I say polynomial fraction, this is polynomial in capital M. So again, we're thinking of the Boolean functions via their truth table. So each Boolean function is a string of length 2 to the capital N. A natural property of Boolean functions should itself have the property that of these strings of length 2 to the capital N, a polynomial, at least some polynomial fraction, should have the property Cn star. And property 2 is that Cn star is computable in polynomial time. So what this says is, the second property, again, polynomial in capital N may look rather bizarre, but what it says is, supposing you're presented with a 0, 1 string of length 2 to the n, you know that that represents a Boolean function, that the value here represents the output when you put in this particular 0, 1 to the little n string. So what we're saying, presented with a truth table of a Boolean function, can you decide whether it has property Cn star in time polynomial in the length of the truth table? So that's what, now, if you want to be a little bit less formal about it, I think one does have to stare at these for a while to get used to them, but if you want to be a little bit formal. Remark about number one, pretty well any definition that you're likely to think of is going to have the property, what they said is, it'll usually have the property that a random function should be complex. So if a random function is complex, this is going to say not just that there's a sort of smallish proportion that belongs to Cn star, but that almost everything belongs to Cn star. So any sort of normal definition, actually this is not just 1 over Pn, it's sort of 1 minus, it's 99% or something like that. But it just so happens that the proof says even if you went down to 1 over Pn, the proof would still work. So, as I say, if your definition happened to have the property that a random Boolean function was complex, then fine, it would satisfy number one. So it's difficult to think of a proof that's somehow going to work for some sort of functions like the clique function, but not for just some, no sort of counting argument would give you that a random function had the property. So a little bit hard to imagine that there would be a proof that didn't have one. So one says most functions are complex. Two says that the notion of complexity that you're using is not so completely weird that you can't even work it out in polynomial time looking at the truth table. So the result of Brasparov and Rudin says, if you're going to do a proof along these lines, then either your notion of complexity has to apply to a very, very small proportion of functions, or it has to be unbelievably weird. Basically, that's... And so weird that nobody... I may be wrong about this, but as far as I gather, nobody has any really serious candidates for what an unnatural proof would look like. So that's the sense in which Brasparov and Rudich have actually given a rather strong reason for why the P equals NP problem is hard. People have even wondered whether this could lead to some proof that it was independent. And there are certain independence results. In very weak axiom systems, you can show that P equals NP is undecidable, I think. I'm getting a little bit out of my depth here. But there are some results along those lines, I think. But definitely not nothing like that has been proved in ZF or anything like that. Now, just a tiny hint about how you might go about proving it. I want to talk a little bit about how could something like this have anything to do with the discrete logarithm problem. Let me just try to give some vague idea of that. Well, let me talk about pseudo-random generators. So supposing I've got... I'm going to talk about capital N because it'll be this is where this will be applied. So probability measure on 0, 1 to the capital N is, let's call it pseudo-random. If basically it is computationally indistinguishable from the uniform measure on 0, 1 to the N. So I'll say pseudo-random for P, but you can replace P by any other complexity class. So pseudo-random for P is going to say that any function in P will not be able to tell the difference between, let's call it something, between pi and the uniform measure. If, so, I'm being a little bit sloppy here, because P should apply to sequences of functions rather than just individual functions. But I'm going to state it like this. This is not quite a totally rigorous definition, but it's easy as an exercise to convert it into the right sort of thing to do with sequences of functions that n varies. So anyway, for any function f in P, the probability according to this probability measure that... f of some sequence epsilon equals 1. So epsilon is a string of length capital N. F, you do some Boolean function to it. The probability that that gives you 1 is almost exactly equal to the uniform probability. Smaller than any, let's say, 1 over polynomial in N. And again, of course, I'm not fixing N and taking any polynomial, but I'm fixing a polynomial in N. But so more loosely, probability measure is pseudo-random if you apply, you think of F as some test that you will apply to the pseudo-random measure. So the pseudo-random measure will give you bit strings, you do F to them, and you know how often you'd get one if they were genuinely random, and you find that you always get the same frequency if you generate them in a pseudo-random way. This gives rise to, but there's a notion of a pseudo-random generator, and that's a function phi to the m to 0.1 to the n. Typically m is much smaller than n, and such a function is called a pseudo-random generator if its output is a pseudo-random measure. Now what do I mean by that? I mean pi will now be the distribution chosen as follows. I pick a uniform random sequence over here, and I apply phi to it. So I'm just taking a random element of the image of phi with multiplicity ultimately, if it's not an injection. So phi would be considered, would be called a pseudo-random generator if, when you apply phi to a random sequence here, you get a random sequence here, which will of course be only a tiny proportion of, it will be supported on a tiny proportion of 0.1 to the n, because m is much smaller than n. And if that is computationally indistinguishable from the uniform measure, then phi is a pseudo-random measure. Put it another way, I take my computable function f. If the probability that f of a random sequence equaling 1 is, for all such functions f, the same as the probability that if I choose a random sequence here, do phi, and then do f to that, if that probability is the same, then f cannot tell if you start producing random strings either uniformly or uniformly from here and doing phi to them. F will not be able to tell you whether which of the two you were doing. I mean, a sort of very simple test might be, does the first bit equal the second bit or something like that? That could be a Boolean function. So here the probability is yes. I mean, here's yes, the probability of half. If this is a pseudo-random generator, then you'll know that if you take a random image of something here, then with probability half, its first bit will equal its second bit, and so on. So again, if I want to be a little bit loose about it, a pseudo-random generator is one that where the output just looks as though it's random. Nothing you can do with your computer will tell the difference. Now, do pseudo-random generators exist? Well, here's an NP problem. Given a sequence here, does it belong to the output of phi? Is it the image of something in 0.1 to the m? That's an NP complete problem. So I just sort of exhibit the sequence and do phi to it and get my thing. So if I want to check that something is in the image of this, I just can do it very easily. If there were a polynomial time algorithm for solving that problem, then that would output 1 only if, or if and only if, I was in the output of this, in the output of phi. I feel as though I'm not saying it's quite clear enough to stick in the head. So here's 0.1 to the n, here's 0.1 to the m, and I do phi, and I get some tiny class of functions. It's pseudo-random, so it's really sort of very spread around in some random-like way, but I'll just draw it over here. It's an NP problem to determine whether I belong to this bit here, because if I've got a sequence, I want to know whether it belongs to the output, I just have to exhibit the thing that maps to it. I'm assuming that phi is a nicely computable function, by the way, of course. In fact, it was a very important remark that I should have made. If there were a polynomial time algorithm for solving that NP complete problem, I'd have a polynomial time algorithm that said whether I was in this set or in this set. That does rather distinguish between this set and the uniform distribution on this set, because it gives me 1 all the time, whereas it should give me 1 almost none of the time if this had been a genuine pseudo-random thing, that would have fooled polynomial algorithms. So the existence of a pseudo-random generator is actually stronger than p not equals np. Nevertheless, people are pretty convinced that pseudo-random generators exist because, subject to certain complexity assumptions, they can build them. And one of the complexity assumptions that can be used to build a pseudo-random generator is precisely the assertion that the discrete logarithm problem is hard. If the discrete logarithm problem is hard, you can exploit that in clever ways to produce pseudo-random generators. And Razborov and Rudich exploited it in a very clever way to produce a pseudo-random generator that had the following property. So it's a pseudo-random, or pseudo-random, let's forget about generators, let's talk about pseudo-random probability measures on 0.1 to the n. They managed to find a probability, assuming the hardness of this, they could find a probability measure on 0.1 to the capital N that supported in the functions of low. So, if the discrete log problem is hard, you can find some subset of dot 1 to the n that consists solely of functions of, well, to be precise, circuit complexity at most n to some constant log n, that's pseudo-random, which means that no function that can be computed in polynomial time in capital N can tell the difference between these and just completely random truth tables of functions. But, if you think about it, if this Cn star is polynomial computable, then it will always output 1 for one of these. But if it's if property 1 holds, then it will output 0 for an appreciable fraction of functions. And so it will have distinguished between the output of the Razbrov-Rudich pseudo-random generator and a genuinely random function. Everything I've said, I'm afraid everything I've said comes into the category of, not how you prove what I've said, but just these facts that I've just told you. They're in the category of things that are easy, but not necessarily easy to see that they're easy, because it's sort of irritating. Perhaps I'll try and say it once more. I'll go around and go do it the other way. So let's say we've got Cn star. Cn star were the complex ones, the ones that are hard to compute. So if Cn star proportion is at least 1 over p, and that says if I pick a random function f, then the probability that it belongs to Cn star is definitely not 0. Sort of some reasonable amount away from 0. However, if what's Cn star supposed to do? It's supposed to pick out functions that have high circuit complexity, and therefore Cn star should never, support of this pseudo-random measure is disjoint from Cn star. So Cn star assigns a measure of 0 to this set of functions. So Cn star really is managing to tell the difference between this set of functions and a uniform distribution, but this was supposed to be a pseudo-random generator. That was supposed to be impossible if Cn star was computable in polynomial time. So what I'm trying to do there is just to give some indication of the main thing I'm not doing is telling you how to get from here to this construction, but just to give you an idea of how that might conceivably come in. Anyway, the conclusion from all that is, if you had thought, well, Morris hadn't said that's the proof, was a rather nice idea. I wonder what would just happen if we tried to generalize it by allowing NOT gates and slightly more. You'll find that Razbrov has been there. Actually, there was another earlier paper in which he showed that the method of approximations itself, just that, was not really of use for non-monotone circuits. And this was a later thing where he said, actually, no other sensible method is useful either. So a lot of people have obviously then gone on to think, now what could an unnatural proof conceivably look like? I'm not saying that there's absolutely no... It would be an exaggeration to say that nobody had even the slightest idea. But it's just, it does seem to be quite a serious obstacle. Roughly, you could say that the problem is that if you think of the set of low complexity functions as a bunch of strings of length capital N, it's a very, very strange set. It's sort of computer scientist equivalent to Mandelbrot set or something. And that's not actually a totally idle analogy, because the Mandelbrot set is what you get when you iterate some function lots and lots of times and then look at the set of things that do one simple thing rather than another simple thing. What is a Boolean function, a sort of computable Boolean function? Well, you've got lots of very, very simple operations that you can do, but you do them over and over again, and then you say, well, what is the set of things such that when you do this particular sequence of very, very simple things, you get a 1 here. The inverse image of a sequence of lots of simple things can be extremely complicated. In both contexts, and
it seems that that complication lies behind the reason that it's hard to prove that low bounds for circuit composed.
In particular, you've got nice computable functions that really look extremely random. Okay, so that now I think I want to start the longish journey towards quantum computation. So I'm actually going to start by talking about other notions of computation that just provide a little bit of a background. Actually, there's one thing in common with what I've just said and quantum computation, which is here we had to get used to 0, 1 to the capital N, some sort of 2 to the N dimensional thing. And in quantum computation, you also have to be comfortable with a 2 to the N dimensional object. Classical computation, you've just got 0, 1 to the N, and that's sort of an N dimensional object, and so we feel reasonably comfortable. With quantum, somehow the number of dimensions we have to worry about is exponentially larger. And from a point of view of understanding things, it's the same problem when you get too many levels in the set theoretic hierarchy, you're sort of thinking about sets and sets of sets. And if you think about properties of sets, then those are sets of sets of sets, and one starts getting less and less comfortable each time you add a layer. So I want to build up to it gradually, just to try to sort of make us feel, including myself, make us feel more comfortable with these sorts of notions. But let me start with something firmly classical, because we're going to talk about... So when I had circuits, we had n inputs and one output. But and I want to have a slightly different model of computation that's a little bit closer to quantum computation, where we have n inputs and n outputs. And also I have an extra property that's... at each stage, what you do is a bijection. So this is what's called reversible computation. So what is a reversible computation? Here's a model of reversible computation. You start with some bits. In our previous model of ordinary circuits, what we did was we'd say things like, if you've got a naught here and a 1 here, then we'll put a 1 there, and if you've got a naught here and a 0 here, we might have an OR gate which creates a number out of 2 bits and off on the ground. Here, we will just take small numbers of bits, actually up to 3 will do. So maybe a simple example, I'll focus on the first 3 bits of my sequence. And I'm going to apply some transformation to the first 3 bits in such a way that what I do is reversible because it's a bijection. So here's the sort of thing I might do. I might say 0, 0, 0. Well, if I see 0, 0, 0, I'll change it to 1, 1, 0. If I see 0, 0, 1, I'll change it to 1, 0, 1. If I see... and so on. And I just take some permutation of 0, 1 cubed and apply that to the first 3 bits. An example, I might say, if the first 2 bits are both 1, then I'll change the value of the third bit. Whatever the third bit was, if it was a 0, I'll make it a 1, if it's a 1, I'll make it a 0. So that's... or another might be, if at least one of the first 2 bits is a 1, then I'll flip the third bit. That would be another example of the kind of thing that you can do. And so I'll do a sequence of such operations. So I'll just pick 3 bits, do some operation, then I'll pick another 3 bits, do some simple operation like that, and eventually I'll get n outputs down there. And if I want to reverse the computation, then I just do the inverses of all those bijections and I go back to where I started. Now you might ask, there are various questions you could ask, such as, well, let's just think about this geometric tension before I go any further. So what is, from the perspective of the first 3 bits, what is 0, 1 to the n? 0, 1 cubed cross 0 1 to the n minus 3. And what does that mean? It means I've got some big n minus n minus n dimensional cube, which I'm going to represent like this. Each of these vertices represents an n minus 3 dimensional cube. And I stick all those n minus 3 dimensional cubes together. Forgot a big portion of it. And that forms for me an n dimensional cube. And if I want to do an operation on just the first three bits, then what I'm doing is I'm taking these n minus 3 dimensional cubes and just permuting them in some way around the vertices while keeping them sort of facing in the same direction that they were before, something like that. So reversible computation is a bit like a rather large Rubik's cube, something like that. A sort of n-dimensional binary Rubik's cube where someone's come up with a really rather clever mechanism that allows you to do arbitrary permutations in any given three directions. You might ask, if you're a Rubik's cube enthusiast, what permutations of 0, 1 to the n can you actually achieve by means of these Rubik's cube moves? It turns out, well, it's easy to check that any such permutation is an even permutation. It's also can be shown it's not that hard that you can get any even permutation. So what I've told you there is I've given you a set of generators for alternating group on 2 to the n. It's nicer to think of it as A, 0, 1 to the n. I won't prove that, but it's not too hard to do it by induction. You sort of, by induction, I can scramble this in some pretty unpleasant ways, and then I can sort of mix that with the last digit here. Another little remark that's of some importance actually for quantum computation is that you can simulate ordinary circuits using reversible computation if you allow yourself some sort of rubbishy extra bits. So supposing I want to do a computation on just the first n bits, so I don't know what they are, and I'll stick a whole lot of zeros on the end, where the number of zeros is going to be comparable to the length of the computation, or the size of the circuit. Now suppose I want to do some circuit calculations. Suppose I wanted to do an OR of the first two bits in a bijective way. Well, that sounds a bit difficult because it does. If I now have a third bit, what I can do is this. I can just say I will flip this bit here if and only if that's a 1 or that's a 1. And that is a bijection. And I'll just leave these two bits unchanged. So these two bits stay unchanged, where they were before, and then that may change to a 1 or something. Because I've set it to be a 0 in the first place, that means this will be the OR of these two. And you can just continue with some sort of process like that. And you can fix your reversible computation so that sort of at this stage that bit will be the output of whatever you wanted your circuit to do. Right, that's reversible. Now that's still, we're still in the little n-dimensional world, but we can very easily get into the capital n-dimensional world just by talking about probabilistic computation. No quantumness needed at this stage. So supposing we wanted to we don't have to do this, but let's do a probabilistic reversible computation. So what I'm going to do here is, instead of saying absolutely definitely what I'll do at some particular stage, I might say something like, I'm going to toss a coin. If it comes up heads, then I will do this, flipping this if and only if these two ones and ones. If it's tails, I'll just leave the whole thing alone. Say that might be part of a probabilistic computation. More generally, I've just got lots of operations and I use some probabilistic means of deciding which step to do at which stage. So how should we, if I don't actually know what the tosses of the coin were, how could we represent a state of the computation? Or perhaps not. So what I don't mean really is the state that the computer's in. We can think of this as a physical computer. It's got some bits in it, and we've got some method of sometimes flipping the bits and that sort of thing. If I don't know what the tosses of the coin were, how could I represent the state of my ignorance about the computer, so to speak, or the state of my knowledge, stroke ignorance about the computer? Well, a very, very simple thing would be to say, supposing I started with a string of zeros, and then I just, with probability of half, I flipped the first bit. That's all I did. A very, very simple operation. Well, I would just naturally represent that as a half times that string, plus a half times that string. And more generally, after I've done made various random decisions, I no longer know precisely what string I've got, but I have got a probability distribution on the string. So I know that I did this with probability 1 over 2 to k or something, and if I did that, then this is the string that I had. So I've got such and such a probability distribution on the cube. So if you're thinking about probabilistic computations, then a natural way of representing the state is simply as a convex combination of vertices of the cube. So we live in a natural way of representing the state of probabilistic computations is to associate, I should say, in case this is not clear, I don't actually mean, when I say half of this plus half of this, I don't mean the vector a half, nor. So now let me say what I do mean. It's to associate with each sequence epsilon equals epsilon 1 up to epsilon n belongs to 0, 1 to the n, a vector v epsilon. And these are sort of basis vector in some vector space, and to take convex combinations . Now we can also talk about trendy things like measurements and collapse of the wave function and so on, just in the world of probabilistic computation. So supposing I've done a probabilistic computation, I now know that, because I haven't been told what the outcomes of the tosses of the coin were, so I now know I've got some particular convex combination of what we call in the eye of the future basis states, so these vectors V epsilon. So V epsilon on its own would represent the state. The string and all the bits in my computer are organized like epsilon, epsilon 1, epsilon 2, and so on. Supposing I measured the first bit, then, So let's just give a name to this. It's not supposed to be a very informative sentence, but these are things like sigma lambda epsilon v epsilon, where epsilon belongs to 0, 1 to the n, lambda epsilon greater than the north, sigma lambda epsilon equals 1. If I measure the first bit and it comes out to be a 1, what is the new state of my computer, as far as I know, so to speak? Well, I now know that the first bit is a 1, but I don't know anything else. So the new state will be sum over all epsilon such that epsilon 1 equals 1, times lambda epsilon phi epsilon. That's the probability that epsilon. So now I need to. I'm adding up all the states where epsilon 1 does equal 1, and then I want to divide by the probability that I did actually get 1. So I divide by it. Divide by that. And that is the new state of what I knew. I just, all the probabilities in the epsilon 1 equals 1 half have the same proportions to each other, but then I divide by this normalizing factor. And I can do some more measurements of all the other bits, and eventually I'll settle down on one of the V epsilons. But it's not really a collapse of the wave function in quantum mechanics sense, it's just a sort of collapse of my ignorance, so to speak, because I now know a little bit more. And I see some wise nods from the audience, because there are deep questions about whether the probabilistic aspect of quantum mechanics is a measure of ignorance. All I'll say is it's not. It's much more. It's something quite different. But nevertheless, so I shouldn't be take this too seriously, but it nevertheless leads rather neatly into quantum mechanics, into quantum computation, because and this is a presentation of quantum computation which I am cribbing mercilessly and probably ruining at the same time from the blog. I highly recommend this, of Scott Aaronson. In particular, there's a if you Google, here's what I suggest. This gives you the idea of the sort of quantum computation since Democritus. It's a series. It's a lecture course that he gave. Started with Democritus and ended up with modern theory of quantum computation. In it, he says the rather nice things that the way people introduce quantum mechanics makes him laugh because it's so daft in his view. So his view, the way it's done, you know, he's all talking about two slit experiments, wave functions, and Schrödinger's wave. After a while, people kind of feel this is very, very odd, and black body radiation and things like that. And that certainly reflects historically the way quantum mechanics was discovered. However, if you come at it from a computer science perspective, you can just sort of rewrite a completely false history of how quantum mechanics was discovered. And it went like this. Somebody was thinking about probabilistic computation and how to measure it, and then they just had this sort of generalized for the sake of it thought, which was, well, here we're looking at sort of linear combinations of basis states. We've got some sort of norm involved, let's see, L1 norm. I wonder if we could do anything, any other norms. They think, well, the obvious next one to try really is the L2 norm. So let's just see what happens. And you see what happens, and out pops quantum computation. And from that, you sort of well into the world of quantum mechanics. I haven't really given myself time to do justice to this thought. But let me just say then, to finish, and we'll talk about it a lot more next time, that the basic state of a quantum computer is just something of the form sigma lambda epsilon b epsilon with sigma lambda epsilon equals 1, with the important extra twist that these lambda epsilons are complex numbers and not just real numbers. Have I got time to say what a measurement is? I think I have. If you measure the first bit and it comes out to be a 1, then the new state you're in. Oh, by the way, so this equal one, yeah, so the new state that you're in will be, well, it's supposed always to have L2 norm 1. This has L2 norm, the sum epsilon 1 equals 1 lambda epsilon squared, so we better divide by, I'll put this in a different colour to emphasise that this is a new thing that I'm doing. This is what we do in the quantum world. We divide by that instead. And also, what's the probability that you get 1? It's again the thing that you divide by on the bottom. So if I measure a bit, or if I do any measurement, say I measure some subset of the of 0-1 to the end, by some, if I can, which that's an issue, it's not very easy to do an arbitrary measurement, but if I measure some subset of the cube, then the probability that it will say, yes, we're in that subset, is going to be just the sum of the squares of these numbers, lambda, epsilon, which are known as the amplitudes. So I've got associated with each basis vector, I've got an amplitude, and the squares of those amplitudes represent probability, but only when you come to measure things, and not before you do that. We don't have to get too worried about the measurement problem in quantum mechanics or anything like that. We just have to think of our state of our quantum computation as being these nice L2 vectors, and only at the very end do we try to organize things so that we don't just get always the probability that epsilon 1 equals 1 is a half or something like that. We want to get some meaningful results. We want to organize the computation so that when we do a measurement, we'll be able to find something interesting out, and that's one of the challenges of quantum computation. All I've told you here is what the states are. I haven't told you how to get from one state to another. That will have to be done next time. So this is just a little tiny sort of taste. I'll say all this again, I think, at the beginning of next time.